A hearty welcome, people loved by God. This is Thy Strong Word, a show devoted to reading, hearing, pondering, and proclaiming the powerful word of our gracious giver, God. I'm your host, William Whedon, LCMS Director of Worship. A joy to be with you today as we turn to the intriguing chapter 11 of the book of Daniel together. And joining us for the exploration to shed great gospel light upon this passage is Pastor Joel Shaltanis of Lord of Life Lutheran Church in Plano, Texas. Pastor Shaltanis, welcome.
Good morning. How you doing, Will?
I'm doing well. You know, I was thinking it's almost exactly like a year ago. Does that mean your conference is just around the corner?
Well, we do it every other year.
So,
No, it was a year ago that we had you out here for the worship conference, and really enjoyed that.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. You know what? We'll let the secret out of the bag here. Pastor Shaltanis has probably the most fun organist in the entire Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I mean, Ben Kaloji is just an amazing organist, but he's beyond being amazing. He's really just fun.
Yeah, that's true. He is actually in Israel right now with on a tour with Paul Meyer. So having a good time and doing that with a lot of some of the folks from the church and others. But yeah, he's missed. But we appreciate him very much here.
Yeah. It will be blazed in my memory forever, watching him do that his variations on "Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing." Mm. He actually sent me a copy of his music of that to look at, and I looked at it. my feet don't go like that. That's amazing.
We did an organ dedication. One of the churches out here in Flower Mound, Lamb of God in Flower Mound, had a beautiful new pipe organ they installed, and they had Benjamin come out and do the dedication, and he played that piece and just blew everybody away. It was amazing.
It's one of those you look at it and think, wait a minute, his hands were there a second ago, weren't they? You know, and his feet, where were they? It's fun. It's an amazingly great piece. By the time you get done, you just want to stand up. Well, it actually did. Usually at these organ recitals, it's a very polite applause at the end.
Right.
He brought the people to their feet screaming at the end. It was fun. All right. Well, enough on that. Before we dig into this chapter, Jenny must really like you to have given you chapter.
I got the phone call. I got the invitation to do this about a year ago when you were down here. I asked you about it, and I put it off. I said, "Oh, I'm busy. I can't. I'll." And then by the time I said, "Well, I better finally agree to do this," and so I said, "Just put me down October, whatever. Let me know what the topic is." And I think at the time, I checked, and you were doing something on the catechism. I thought, "Oh, no problem. Catechism. I'm a parish pastor. I can do this, all day long." And then I get the topic, and it's Daniel 11.
We invited President Harrison into the show yesterday, and he said, "What's the topic?" I said, "Daniel." He goes, "Bye." All right. Well, this is really going to be a fun chapter to ponder our way through. But before we dig in, would you be kind enough to ask God's blessings on our time together?
Certainly. Lord, bless us, we pray, that you would give us insight into your holy word, and that you would bless all who read it and learn it, that we might take it to heart, that it might grow in us, and that we might grow in faith and devotion to you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. A reminder to our hearers, you can feel free to join in the discussion anytime during the hour. Send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org or call in locally at 314-821-0850 or around the country at 1-800-730-2727. Well, we sort of had the interlude, if you will, of chapter 10. But at the end of 9, we had this talk about the abomination. On the wings of abomination shall come one who makes desolate until the time decreed. I think that actually is kind of a direct hookup to what we're going to be looking at in this chapter. Do you have any specific introduction you want to give to these words?
Well, let me ask you, first of all, I didn't hear yesterday's show. I was teaching a Bible class myself. What did you do with verse 1 of chapter 11? Did you include that, as most commentators do, at the end of chapter 10?
To get the rest of the chapter to hook up with the time given in this chapter, we didn't actually deal with the specific question, but it makes a great deal of sense.
Yeah, that's what most of the commentators have done. No, let's just get right into it.
Okay, all right. Well, chapter 11 of Daniel, verse 1. And as for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will show you the truth. Behold, 3 more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the 4 winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these. And we'll stop at that point. Any light you can shed on this for us?
Well, I think... And let me just be honest about my sources and transparent about that. I am largely relying on Steinman's commentary. Excellent. The one recently published, CPH, in the Concordia Commentary Series. Also checked as a few others, but largely relying there.
And let's just add the additional piece of information that when it comes to sorting out and figuring out the puzzle of biblical chronology, he's like the master anyway.
Yeah, he's extremely helpful. And I think, you know, most of us parish pastors don't spend a whole lot of time in this intertestamental period with the years, the dates, and all of that. But his work is extremely helpful in mapping this all out. But according to he and others and who have mapped this out, and pretty much everyone's agreed upon that these 3 kings that arise in Persia are Cambyses, Gaumata, and Darius the First. The fourth, far richer than all of them, is Xerxes. And then there's a gap between verse 2 and 3 where it goes on to talk about the mighty king, which nearly everyone has agreed is Alexander the Great. But there are actually 6 more Persian kings in between there that are unmentioned, that these first 4 are by far the more famous. And the reason I bring that up is that there are gaps of time in here. And with prophecy about things to come, you can't fault the author for not mentioning every single detail. And yet this prophecy in particular is very detailed. So he will mention many things, but he doesn't mention everything.
And I come back to a phrase that I remember Dr. Hummel trotting out at seminary, the proleptic foreshortening of the time spectrum. the easiest way to think about it is think of prophecy as you're looking across a terrain. And I had this happen to me up in Regina, Canada, and there was a valley that you just looked right over. You didn't see it. You know, it was down and following the course of a river, and we were actually, the place where I was headed was down in that valley. But I mean, I was like, well, I don't see any town. Where's, you know, there, as far as you can see, there's nothing here. And you looked right over it. I think prophecy just simply does that sometimes. It, the part that he's looking at the end, but that doesn't mean you've seen every valley between where he's looking and the end.
Right, and it's so important to note that, because people want to unfairly criticize, well, he didn't mention this one, he didn't mention that one. That wasn't his goal.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't his goal. So the mighty king, Alexander, verse 3, ruling with great dominion, does as he wills. He is unequaled in power and sweeps the world away and you know, conquers.
He weeps because there are no more worlds to conquer.
Yeah, really, really.
Yeah.
And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom is divided. Then this talks about the division among his four generals. But not to his posterity. It notes Alexander had a half-brother, and he had an infant son who was not yet born when he died. But both were murdered. There was no posterity to Alexander to inherit his kingdom, so it was divided up among the generals.
Yeah, yeah. So it looked promising with his daddy, Philip of Macedon, but... he does, I mean, all the what we would call, to, I mean, how far does this stretch? We're talking about he reached into India, right?
Right, right.
Persia, or what we would call Iran, Iraq, all the way back to Greece. I mean, the entire Middle East
right.
was, I mean, the man literally walked across it. It's almost, then a mighty king shall rise. That's almost irony for understatement there.
Right.
He does achieve something that none of the others came close to, but it was so ephemeral. Everything that he worked for was so big, and yet it slips through his fingers with death. It reminds me so much of the Psalms, you know, trust not in princes, they are but mortal. Wow. Okay. Any further comment on those particular verses?
No, but you know what? You asked about an introductory comment. I do want to share something about this, and because it, as we go on from here, it's just more of the battling back and forth of the kings, and specifically we're going to be narrowing in on the king of the south and the king of the north. But that's where this is going to go for the next 20 verses or so. And about this point about how much... how specific this gets, you know, I think it's interesting because a lot of prophecy is not this detailed, and this is so detailed, of course, that many have said, well,
it can't be prophecy. Detailed. Yeah.
All the critics have rejected it, but this is old. This isn't just 19th century Germans who are rejecting this. This goes back to Porphyry, a writer in the second century, dies in 300, and Jerome takes up issue with him. Because even back then he was saying, oh, this is too detailed. It had to have been written at the time of the Maccabees. There must have been, you know, it's too good. It couldn't be foresight. And so how do you answer that charge? I'm always thinking of the apologetic, you know, how do you deal with the skeptics? And it's just an interesting question. Why do we need to know this? Why does God inspire Daniel to give us all this detailed knowledge? And I think it's a good question. Are you familiar with... H.C. Leupold, who wrote several commentaries in the Old Testament.
Right.
He's got this great line, if you'll permit me a quote.
Mm-hmm.
He says, there's another deeper reason why such details as these are worthy of the work of the spirit of prophecy. And that is that what is foretold here is in reality, with minor variations, the pattern into which all history falls. Is there not an appalling sameness about this business of leagues and pacts between rival nations, of disagreements, wars, alliances, political marriages, recriminations, treachery, temporary ascendancy, defeat, and utter downfall, of recovery through some aggressive leader, and then the same thing all over again with a slightly different sequence of events? From this point of view, there's a drab sameness about history, which allows us to say that in addition to being a prophecy of a particular period of Syrian and Egyptian history, this may be regarded as a panoramic view of all history.
That's very well stated.
Yeah, I think it helps to put it into perspective. This is just, you know, we see the same thing again and again. And I think in our own day, you know, with people thinking about, oh, the Iran deal and these pacts and between, you know, these countries, and, oh, the frustration and the rulers and the vying and
that it's the same place.
Yeah, right.
So, actually, this place, I think, also is a key to why some of the detail here is this is not just world history. This is as it specifically impinges on Israel.
Right.
And this is where God is preparing to stage the redemption of the entire world. And this setup is vital for it. It is great that I'm glad you mentioned the Maccabees. Be sure to pick up your Concordia Apocrypha and read through the Maccabees. They are very, very helpful for getting the, they tell the story after having lived it. Daniel is prophesying it. Right. And so they actually are, they clarify even what's here.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, and it just sets up again that God's people are suffering greatly, like you said. They're caught in the middle of all this turmoil, and yet it's all in God's timing. It's all in control. He's aware of it. He knows it. He's directing it, and he hasn't forgotten his people. That's kind of the overriding understanding. If there's gospel here at all, it's that God is. It's all happening in God's time.
And so the standard line through all of apocalyptic literature is always this, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. We have Mike calling from St. Louis. Hey, Mike.
How are you doing today?
Doing well. What about you?
Oh, I can't complain. I'm okay.
Good.
I was going to say, in Daniel chapter 8, verse 5, it talks about the goat with the horn on his forehead. And I think it symbolizes Alexander the Great, because remember when they were at war with Persia, he told his soldiers, he goes, follow me, and he led him, and he went straight for the king of Persia, and the king of Persia got scared for his life and took off, and then of course his army just deserted, and then he himself was killed by his bodyguards, but before he died, he left his daughter in his will to Alexander the Great, and her name was Roxanne. And Alexander the Great married her, and they had a child. And when he died, she went back to Greece. Like it says, in that verse 4, chapter 11, verse 4, it said he had no descendants because when she went back to Greece, she was killed. And Alexander the Great's son was thrown in a cauldron of fire. So that fulfilled that part of the prophecy.
Yeah, that's very, very sad. When you think about how one man could, just the tragedy of Alexander's life. I mean, it is a fascinating story that has enthralled people across the centuries.
And we're going to see in the text coming up here too that sort of vengeance against the trying to get the successor and make sure that they can't inherit the kingdom. That's going to happen between between Ptolemy and the Seleucids as well.
Right. Right. It sets up the great violence to come. So verse 5. Then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. After some years they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure. But she shall be given up, and her attendants, he who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times. And from a branch from her roots, one shall arise in his place. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal with him and shall prevail. He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images, and there are precious vessels of silver and gold. And for some months he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. Then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. Okay.
Yeah. Well, this is the describing of the rise of the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria. Yeah, back and forth it goes. We've got, I don't, do you want to go verse by verse on this? And
sure, if you want to help us understand what's, you know, who, I will add, if you've got your Lutheran Study Bible, you have Andrew Steinman's wonderful little map, because keeping the Ptolemies and the Seleucids straight is enough to make.
I have it right in front of me.
Yeah.
It gets pretty, pretty confusing. But anyway, we've got, going back to verse 5, you've got Ptolemy in Egypt being talked about. The king of the south is strong. Seleucus I is here mentioned as the prince, because at some point he goes and is in Egypt, and Ptolemy sets him up as a general or gives him some sort of official power before he goes back to Syria. They make an alliance with the daughter of the king of the south. This is Ptolemy II's daughter, Berenice, who they think, well, if we marry her to one of the successors of the Seleucids, Antiochus II, then, you know, everything will be fine. Their heir will become their united ruler of all, and everything, it'll all work out. Of course, it doesn't.
So it'll put an end to it. It's basically something of it's not civil war, but I mean the fact that they were at once one empire,
right?
And now it's a power struggle. The thought is if you marry these two together, we're going to have peace,
right? Which of course doesn't happen.
No,
yeah. And in fact, this is where we were just talking about with Alexander, the posterity is wiped out. Antiochus II he also goes back to his previous wife, Laodice, if I'm saying this correctly, and then ends up rejecting Berenice, who is in turn murdered by Laodice, and Ptolemy and their infant son as well is wiped out. So it's...
It's a vicious, awful, ugly story.
It is. It's all of the schemings and attempts to try to make peace, and yet there's too much greed for power in all of this. It's not going to work.
It's the tomcat eating the kittens.
Yeah.
So. Maybe we should just let's keep on reading. We're almost at time for a break, but we'll include this a little bit further.
Okay.
Verse 10, his sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overflow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight against the king of the north. And he shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. And when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. For the king of the north shall again raise a multitude greater than the first. And after some years, he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. All right, just barely a minute or two before we have to go to the bottom of the show. Can you give us a hint about what's happening here?
Yeah, again, it's just the next generation, but the fight continues between the north and the south, and you have back and forth between Antiochus III, who's called the Great, because he does conquer a lot. He will give birth to, he doesn't give birth to.
He's the daddy of.
Yes, thank you. He's daddy of Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, who's that detestable man that we'll talk about, I'm sure, at some length here coming up after the break. But there's this back and forth, and eventually what does happen is Antiochus captures southern Syria and Palestine, and he takes over the Holy Land at this point, and it'll never go back to Ptolemaic control again. And so most significantly there, that this is the end of Israel being ruled or being a vassal state of Egypt.
Of Egypt, yeah. The Egyptian connection is finally, that never comes back. All right. Well, we will, with that, go to these announcements. And when we come back, we'll move on to Epiphanies and the Antichrist.
Hi, this is Dave Schmidt inviting you and your golf buddies to participate in Christian Friends of New America's third annual golf tournament, Tuesday, October 13th at Norwood Hills Country Club. Funds raised help CFNA welcome refugees and new Americans in the name of Jesus Christ as CFNA helps them establish a new life through Bible studies, tutoring, health screenings, citizenship, and ESL classes. It also provides scholarships so they can attend LCMS schools. Please join us. More information at cfna-stl.org/golf.
All around the world, there are people who are afraid of spirits. One such place is an island near Australia called Papua New Guinea, or PNG for short. While you and I know that we can trust Jesus to take care of us, a lot of people in PNG don't know how powerful the Savior is. Just like us, the PNG people need God, and the children in your Lutheran Day School or Sunday School can help. Learn more about adopting this children's mission project at lhfmissions.org.
Well, welcome back to Thy Strong Word right here on KFUO, the messenger of good news. Our special guest today, Pastor Joel Shaltanis of Lord of Life Lutheran Church in lovely Plano, Texas. And a reminder, you can feel free to join in the discussion anytime during the hour. Send an email to KFUO at KFUO.org or call in locally at 314-821-0850 or around the country at 1-800-730-2727. I'm going to go ahead and just read two more paragraphs here to move us along because it is a long chapter. Verse 14, in those times, many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violent among your own people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. Then the king of the north shall come and throw up siege works, and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. But he who comes against him shall do as he wills, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his hand. He shall set his face to come with the strength of his whole kingdom, and he shall bring terms of an agreement and perform them. He shall give him the daughter of a woman to destroy the kingdom, but it shall not stand or be to his advantage. Afterward, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them. But a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. Then he shall turn his face back toward the fortresses of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. Then shall arise in his place one who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days he shall be broken, neither in anger nor in battle. In his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given, he shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with small people. Without warning, he shall come into the richest parts of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his fathers' fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoils, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set up against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land. Okay.
Well, I think that pretty much speaks for itself. Let's go on. No.
Good try.
No, I'm sensing you want to keep moving here, so I don't want to hit every last
it's okay.
Bit of it. Let me just get a couple of highlights here. That in the first section you read, verses 14 and 19, you've got, again, the struggle going on between Egypt and Syria, and how it affects the glorious land. When you hear this mention of the glorious land and
the Holy Covenant.
Yeah, that's Palestine. That's the Jewish people. You have another marriage alliance attempt here in verse 17. He shall give him the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom. That this is Antiochus III, the Great, giving his daughter Cleopatra I over to Ptolemy V to be thinking that if they get married, then he's hoping to undo Ptolemy this way by through his daughter. But eventually she remains loyal to her husband. It doesn't work. But at least she isn't murdered off like Berenice and the others when they tried this two generations prior.
Mm-hmm.
You've got battles back and forth and back and forth. And throughout this, too, Antiochus III is defeated pretty roundly by the Romans, by others. And so he is at the Battle of Magnesium, 190 B.C., Antiochus IV is taken as a hostage, as a part of the defeat. One of the terms was they took several hostages, including the king's son. And Antiochus, who's this detestable person we're going to be talking about at length, he actually grows up in Rome.
Which might explain a little bit of the brutality.
Right, right. And the scope of it, too, that it's not just a local king, but it's one with connections to this rising empire. Let's see, what else do we have here in the next? You've got more of this backstabbing and conniving. You've got this exactor of tribute, Heliodorus, who it's thought that he was maybe in league with Antiochus IV because at some point, I'm going to get my names right, Antiochus III here is poisoned. And it's thought that Heliodorus did it. That's the suspicion. And it falls right in line with the time that Antiochus IV was returning to the land.
Mm.
Now, he's not set up as a successor. There is an older son that's supposed to be in line ahead of him, but somehow it works out that he goes to Rome now to be the hostage, and Antiochus comes out. And so you've got this line about him, whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. That's verse 21.
Mm-hmm.
He, through deceitful matters, becomes king. He's not; it doesn't come by it honestly. And
there's almost an echo there, or there will be an echo of this later on down the line, I think, with Herod the Great, too. again, somebody that's sort of a usurper,
right,
in the same area. So yeah, and so this idea of the kingdom passing to the firstborn is that's not what happens here.
Right. Notably, also, what's going on here, verse 22, it says, armies shall be bitterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. Now we're probably, what Steinman and others suggest is that this is a Jewish high priest, probably Onias III, and that there were several priests at this time vying for the power. Bribes are made to Antiochus Epiphanes to let them take over. You've got, what are the names? Menelaus and Jason, I think, were the high priests at this time, who were paying bribes, trying to be selected as the one. And again, it shows that there's money to be made in this position, right, of being the high priest, but also power. And it's suggested that, well, Antiochus goes with the one who's going to allow Hellenization, because as we learn about him, he wants nothing to do with Jewish tradition, Jewish law, Jewish rituals. He's going to try to undo all of it. And he wants the chief priest who will be a help to him and not a burden.
So Hellenization, the actual adopting of Greek culture.
Right.
Right. Okay. All right. Let's read a little further. At the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south. But it shall not be his time as it was before, for ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the Holy Covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering. And they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant. But the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they shall receive a little help. And many shall join themselves to them with flattery, and some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end. For it still awaits the appointed time. Now we get to the heart, I think, of what Daniel was, you know, wanting to get to in this prophecy.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. Notice, too, the first and last words that you read in this section are the same. The appointed time are talked about here. And again, it's that reminder that God is always in control of it, and it's all happening in God's time. But what we need to talk about here is that this is Antiochus really hammering the children of Israel here.
This is the Book of Maccabees.
Exactly. And for the listeners, if you haven't read this, this goes into the detail, and it's graphic and it's disturbing, but it's like it's right like reading Eusebius on the persecutions. You hear about these poor people and how they're being persecuted and how they try to fight, and
the story of the mother with her sons,
I think.
That's just, it's heart-wrenching,
right,
but
right,
powerful, yeah.
And there's, interesting how they handle it, too. There's that one point where they don't want to violate the Sabbath, and so some of the Jews refuse to fight back, and 1,000 of them are slaughtered. And they realize, well, that's not going to work. We need to fight on the Sabbath, or we're going to be wiped out. But just the fact that they were so, you know, concerned to be faithful in the face of this persecution, anyway, but let's probably should go to the text here and look at the details.
Yes.
You know, this is interesting that verse 30, the ships from of Kittim, or Kittim, these are Roman. Then at some point when he was invading Egypt, the second time when he comes into the south, He is afraid because the Romans say, you're not taking Alexandria, you need to go back. And there is the expression, the line in the sand, comes from an incident that happens here. Roman Gaius Papilius Laenas at some point is negotiating with Antiochus. Well, really just kind of puts it to him and says, what are you doing here? And he draws a circle around him and he says, before you step out of this circle, I need to have your answer that you're not going to attack, the Egyptians. You're going to have Rome as an enemy. And Antiochus is trapped. I mean, he has to, in very short order, decide, I can't go against Rome. So he goes back. He's angered. And what does he do? He goes to Jerusalem and takes out and vents his anger on the children of Israel. And that's when you get this, the abomination that makes desolate. We should probably talk about
yes,
that.
Yes, please.
It's thought that this is the idol of Zeus that was set up in the temple. But along with it, as you see, that there is also just the sacking of the temple with all of the accoutrements, the gold, all of it is taken away and destroyed. Well, am I getting that right here? There's thought that they would have been sacrificing pigs at
pigs,
this point.
Pigs, yeah.
And so the question is then, when this is done, it just makes desolate. Nobody has any interest in, no faithful believer can be found there because it is desecrated.
So desolate here means empty.
Yeah.
In other words, by the takeover, the Hellenistic takeover of the Jewish cult, the cultus, the worship, the faithful people of God turn and ran away from it. They couldn't recognize, even though it was their temple, they couldn't recognize what was happening there as true worship.
Well, you said that a lot better than what I was just trying to say.
No, I was just trying to say what you were saying. So the fact, though, that after the people are running away from the worship and no longer gathering there, and the faithful, it says he shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people of God will stand firm and take action. What's all that?
It's thought that this is that high priest that he's installed, this Menelaus, was complicit with Antiochus IV, that he was going along with the whole Hellenization. And they saw this as a way to power.
Let's throw this out there because it's true. It got so bad that the Jews would try to undo, like they would have public baths and they would try to undo their circumcisions, to look Greek, to be Greek, because that was the big thing, to be conformed to the world.
Hmm.
So they are under pressure to get with the program and be like everybody else. Boy, does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
And yet those who are still fighting are not united among themselves. It sounds like there's still struggle and strife there.
Right. It talks about those who know their God shall stand firm, and most take this to mean the devout Jews and Mattathias and his sons, especially Judas Maccabeus, mm-hmm. who rise up and take action and fight. And and yet, though, as you see in verses 33, by no means are they always successful. Many shall stumble by sword and flame, captivity and plunder. There will be persecution. And yet it's thought that when they stumble, they will receive a little help. This is from the Maccabees and others who resist. It's interesting, too, the commentators note that why is it called a little help? And I think Steinman gets it best when he says that God's the real help. Man may come to it for a time and offer a little relief, but God is their ultimate savior and help in the whole thing. And yet you see that many will join themselves then with flattery. Some are going to pretend to be on the side of the faithful, but they're just taking that side when it's convenient. And some of the wise shall stumble. But then we get to the whole purpose of it. Why is it happening? Why does this persecution take place? That they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end. And this persecution causes an increase in faithfulness. And many Jews would now look for the Messiah. And just as, in our own times, Christians, especially in persecution, are waiting for the return of the Messiah as well. And mm-hmm. it tends to purify the faith, like it says here, refine and purify it.
Yeah. And here you have the image that Peter will pick up in, you know, about how, you know, don't be astonished at the trials that come upon you. They're purifying you. They're refining you. So that's a theme that runs throughout the apocalyptic literature. So verse 36, and the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what is decreed shall be done. He shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers, or the one beloved by women. He shall not pay attention to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. He shall honor the God of fortresses instead of these, a God whom his father did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He shall deal with the strongest fortresses with the help of a foreign God. Those who acknowledge him, he shall load with honor. He shall make them rulers over many and shall divide the land for a price. So it sounds like this God sets him, or this king sets himself up as God.
Right. And I think what's important to note here is if we go back to verse 35, that when it writes until the time of the end, most commentators recognize that this is signaling a transition, that we're not just talking about Antiochus IV now, who's, what, about 150 or so B.C. Now we're talking about, or 160 B.C., now we're talking about the end, and that this is now going to the end of all things, not necessarily to be understood as a continuation of Antiochus.
We have another one of those valleys in front of us,
right?
And it looks like it's right on the same level, the
right.
same thing.
And there are many, you know, this is where it gets particularly messy. I mean, there's all kinds of disagreement about how to interpret this stuff, but in the last, 36 to the end, you just have people all over the place, and you've got people saying, no, this is Antiochus, and they try to make it fit, but they say, oh, it doesn't fit. And the critics, of course, say, well, you know, it was written at the time of Antiochus, and they tried to guess the future and got it wrong. And others say, no, it's talking about the end times now.
Well,
and now we need to think about the Antichrist.
So Luther's comment, this is in the Lutheran Study Bible at the beginning of chapter 11. I think it's a good one to hear. He says, Daniel prophesies to his people, the Jews or Judeans, almost exactly as he does in the 8th chapter concerning Alexander the Great and the two kingdoms, Syria and Egypt, chiefly on account of Antiochus, called the Noble, who is to plague the Jews. But he describes Antiochus in such a way that his words ultimately tend, under the figure of Antiochus, to portray the very Antichrist. And so Daniel is actually referring here to these last times of ours just before the last day. For all teachers are unanimously agreed that these prophecies about Antiochus point to the Antichrist. So I think that's a very helpful agreement with what you just said, that we have here a look ahead towards the end. So if this is the Antichrist, what are the characteristics of Antichrist that are given here? I mean, how's he described?
Well, exalts himself, magnifies himself. He does as he wills. This was said of Alexander the Great, the same phrase. So that you have this idea that powerful. And yet, with his power, it's not—it's not just so much a worldly power, but as it says, he will do it his wills, and then he goes into religious matters. And so, this causes many people to think that, you know, because he magnifies himself above every god and speaks astonishing things against the God of gods, that he is powerful, and yet exercises his power or abuses this power in religious matters. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished. For what is decreed shall be done. He shall pay no attention to the gods of his fathers. Which that phrase "God of his fathers" always refers to the covenant people, the you know, God of Abraham, Isaac, and so you're thinking in terms of this is somebody who comes from the line of or the God of his fathers would be that he would be of the people of God.
The way that Zossi always said it is the Antichrist is religious. You know, you find the Antichrist among the people of God.
Right.
You don't look for him just as a worldly political figure. But
right.
He is a political figure, and this guy dishes out rewards to the people that actually, you know, go along with him. Let me read to the end of the chapter. We have a couple callers on the line, and we got see if we could actually wrap this up.
Okay.
Verse
yeah.
40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. But the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and with many ships. And he shall come into countries and shall overflow and pass through. He shall come into the glorious land and tens of thousands shall fall. But these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab and the main part of the Ammonites. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall become ruler of the treasures of gold and of silver and all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Cushites shall follow in his train. But news from the east and the north shall alarm him. And he shall go out with great fury to destroy and devote many to destruction. And he shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. Ooh, after it sounded like he always gets his own way. That's kind of a nice ending.
Right, and you hear that throughout the whole chapter. There's all the scheming and plotting, and what does it result in? Nothing, and God brings it down and makes them low, and it goes on. It's kind of like that comet loophole, that this is just kind of this never-ending cycle of power grab and failure and persecution and repeat, and yet God is in control and directing all of it for his purpose.
Yeah, this passage was especially important for the reformers when they argued against the shape of the medieval papacy, and especially the claim that was made that, you know, for the salvation of any person, it is imperative
right.
that they be in submission to the Roman pontiff.
Well, I was kind of hoping I could...
I'm not going to let you escape by it. No.
But you know, let me just point out this that interpretation of the office of the papacy as the Antichrist as fulfilling these things in Daniel 11, the reformers didn't invent that. And Simon says that this has been around for about 300 years by the time of the Reformation.
Right.
And I think too that like you just brought up Boniface VIII and the whole unum sanctum,
which yes.
will be saved, has to acknowledge. You know, it's clearly when you look at popes like that at the time of you know Crusades and after, you look at this and it's just as if that's exactly who it's talking about. It's clear as day. I think why that argument is so difficult because you look at a man like John Paul II or Benedict XVI, and you think, what? These guys are, you know, grandfatherly types.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to fit.
Yeah, you know, they're kissing babies on TV, and you think, oh, this isn't... He wants to call that the Antichrist, right? You know, and so, you know, I think their judgment on this matter was that this office of the papacy that sets itself up at this position of power... they make much of that phrase in 37 too, that will not regard the desire of women as being, you know, particularly fulfilling the vow of celibacy and what mm-hmm. have you. You know, but with the whole thing, this is stuff that goes on till the end. I think it'll make sense looking back, but we haven't reached the end yet, you know, and we'll have to see.
It might have been one of the valleys.
Yeah.
So there, the prophets, I think, again, I'm going to quote Zossi. He says, how the Lord will allow this to come to fulfillment in the final horrors of the end times is something we cannot say. What we can say is in the history that we have seen to this day, we see these marks fulfilled, particularly in the way the medieval papacy tried to claim both swords, etc.,
right.
and bind all people for salvation to it. Well, That was, you know, hey, man, you did it. Thank you. Yeah, I know. I apologize to Larry and Mike. We had you there. I had to get through the chapter, and I had to let Pastor give his final say here. Thank you guys very much. If you guys want to call back tomorrow with your comments, we can still inflict parts of chapter 11 on Pastor Walther or Pastor Ladle. I'm not sure which one's going to be here tomorrow. Since they get the rest of 12 so easy, we should do that to them. So feel free to call back with those questions tomorrow.
I'm at a golf tournament for the Lutheran school tomorrow, so no thanks. Don't call back.
All right. Take care, people loved by God. This is Thy Strong Word.